he likes playing with like the saint sinner thing, you know, this guy that paints himself as the victim. He's not a drug addict. He doesn't, right. The only thing he does is milk. It's like, yeah. Milk's good for you, right? You know, he starts off as Jesus Christ and ends up as Charles Manson.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of The Envelope. Kelvin Washington here, and you know who we have. We have Yvonne Didier, we have Mark Olson, and you as well. So thank you for being here. We got to start with this. Happy holidays to the both of you. Seems only fitting. First off, the green memo.
I feel like you guys have left me off the group text again.
We did.
I'm not getting these messages.
By the way, tomorrow will be your Christmas trees and what, but we'll talk about that later. Don't worry about that. Quickly, any like Christmas list. One thing you're looking for.
A break. Sorry, I answer before you even finish.
You know our like bosses and producers are looking at us right now. I can see that. You deserve one, Mark. You?
That sounds good. Sure. Okay.
All right, that was it. Thank you for watching this episode.
Let's go.
All right, let's get into it. As always, we got some great guests for you. Yvonne, you had a chance to speak with Oscar Isaac, who's taking on the role, of course, as Frankenstein in Guillermo del Toro's adaptation of this classic. Tell me a little bit more.
Yeah, so he plays, you know, the brilliant but egotistical scientist, Victor Frankenstein, who, you know, creates life with this monstrous experiment, and the result is the creature, played by Jacob Elordi. But it was really nice speaking with Oscar about some of the themes that the film explores, the father-son dynamic and breaking generational trauma, breaking cycles. And he was talking a lot about where he pulled from, the conversations he had with Guillermo about, you know, what they wanted to delve into. And it was really fun also hearing him talk about some of the inspiration, the rock star inspiration for his take on Victor. So it was fun.
All right. We're looking forward to that. We'll get there in just a moment. Marcus, when you had a chance to speak with Wumi Masaku, who in my mind was the kind of the breakout star of Ryan Coogler's vampire thriller Sinners. I want to hear more about what you had to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this has been such a breakout role for her. Obviously, the film was a huge hit when it came out earlier in the year. And, she's been acting for years now. I think a lot of people know her from when she was on Lovecraft Country, another sort of horror-themed story. But here she plays Annie, the former partner of Smoke, one of the two characters played by Michael B. Jordan in the film. And just on a practical level, it was great to hear her talk about working with Michael, where he's playing these two parts, and the way he made it seem so effortless to move, shift back and forth between them. But then also on an emotional level, you know, she was born in Nigeria, raised in England, lives here in Los Angeles, and yet she just forged such a deep personal and emotional connection to this character from 1930s Mississippi. And so to hear her talk about that, there was just something really wonderful in the conversation. It was really terrific.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, it happens all the time, as you all know, that moments like this, scenes like those in the movie, like she's going to become someone that's, hey, you know what? We need to look into her more. And so I'm happy for her to have that breakout moment. All right, without further ado, here is Yvonne and Oscar.
Thanks so much for being here.
Very happy to be here, Ivana.
I have to say, driving down the 110, I came across, no lie, 5 buses with your face wrapped around them.
I'm so sorry.
It was a pleasant sight in LA, and I know you encounter a level of this with each project, but this does feel a little bit different. Like, talk to me about how you're feeling in this moment with Frankenstein. Like, how do you take stock of the small moments in this big production?
Yeah, well, there aren't too many small moments with this, to be honest. Everything's very big, very big sized. It's, in a way, it's the most I've really done to support a movie. I mean, I'd say even more than Star Wars to a certain extent. Mm. Because it straddles so many things. It's a big, fun popcorn movie. It's also, you know, an intense emotional drama. It's a platform release, you know, a few theaters and a few more theaters, and then the streaming platform itself. Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of things to do for that. And it can be tiring, but the thing is, when it's in service of Guillermo and his vision, and also his, you know, it's his love letter to cinema, it's the story he's always wanted to tell. And that's an energizing thing, being able to do it with him and with Jacob and Mia.
Have you come across a bus with your face on it yet?
Maybe not a bus. I've seen billboards. Okay. I've seen like bus stops. But the actual moving thing itself, no, I haven't yet.
still time. I know he has said that he has long seen you as the person to play this role of Victor, even before there was a screenplay. What do you remember about that lunch you had with Guillermo where he sort of said, I want to do this project and I want you to do it? What did he say that he saw in you for this?
Yeah, well, I wish I could really go back and like just parse it all out. But I just remember that, you know, we just immediately started speaking as friends, as fellow Latinos, as immigrants, as, you know, trying to navigate our way through this industry, as both having very intense relationships with our fathers and the way that that's changed over time, both becoming fathers and, you know, wanting to not necessarily follow in some of the same footsteps as well, but also recognizing what an incredible source of life our fathers have been. But all the pain that came from that and forgiveness. And so we talked about those things without any relation to a movie in my mind. And it wasn't until after that where he started talking about this project. And he said, I think you need to play Victor Frankenstein. And, you know, he hadn't planned on that. When I came to meet him, it was just a general. He wasn't thinking about me for Victor. And it wasn't until after we spoke that then he kind of made the connection and thought, actually, this is who I want to play this role.
You know, I feel like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein feels like it's so steeped in the culture because of the creature, the monster is so a part of pop culture. But when did you first encounter the book? Did you have to read it in high school?
The book, yeah, the book I encountered it, I encountered it a little later. It was just like shortly after high school. I was just, you know, I wanted to have a read because of, you know, it's such a famous, you know, legendary, iconic book. But it didn't, you know, like I enjoyed it, but it didn't really hit so hard for me, you know? And it wasn't until I went back and, you know, when I left that meeting, that Guillermo gave me Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and the Tao Te Ching. He's like, read these two books. And so it was that going back to the book again, reading it, really hearing her voice in all of the characters. I thought that was very interesting, that everybody kind of sounds a little bit like her. And I love that Guillermo took that idea and did the same thing with his movie. You know, he made it very autobiographical.
For The Card Counter, you also had to read a book about, you know, the way that we store trauma. Did you find yourself returning to that at any point?
Yeah, The Body Keeps the Score. That's right. It's an incredible book. I did very much also like parts therapy, you know, this idea that like we're all these different parts and different voices and we're not any one thing. And gestalt therapy, this you know, idea of like being able to hold that child self of you that's broken. For me, that was a very big one in thinking of the creature. That the creature is, you know, a reconstruction of Victor's broken child that has to kind of chase him down to forgive him, to like make him look at him, face him and forgive him.
Did you find that you wanted to understand both of these characters?
Yeah, Guillermo and I spoke very explicitly about the idea that they're one and the same, that they're two halves of one full person. And that actually was really helpful in the playing of it, particularly in that one scene when the creature comes back and demands a companion. That scene in particular was played on my part as if that's his voice, his inner child, his addict, his that darkness within him that he's trying to suppress.
How did you both discuss Victor in terms of, is he a reliable narrator telling this story?
Right. Well, we spoke that he's very much an unreliable narrator. It is his remembrance. It's a memory play. And so, you know, did Elizabeth really look like his mom? Probably not. But that's how he remembers it. That's who he saw. So we you know, exactly the sets for these massive archetypal Jungian visions that feel very much like they're part of his inner conscious, his subconscious, and not so much, you know, as like a objective reality.
I want to talk about the look and vibe of Victor. I know that you've talked before about, you know, looking to some rock icons for inspiration, whether it's Prince or David Bowie. I think Guillermo mentioned Mick Jagger at one point. And how did you both arrive at that? And what were sort of the videos or performances that you locked in on.
Well, it's just like that first meeting that we had, you know, it wasn't so much like he saw me, he's like, you're my Victor. It's conversation. And I think just keeping the conversation going, and out of that conversation, you know, inspiration starts to happen. So I, you know, that I feel is what ultimately led for this thing to happening between us. And that conversation just keeps going. And so, you know, as he writes it, you know, he has a few ideas. He has a few scenes. I look at a few scenes. I see where he's going with it. We start talking about it more. He starts talking about, you know, the way he wants Victor to occupy space, especially in his memory, that he remembers himself like conducting a concert, like a rock star, like holding court, and having like this punk rock iconoclastic energy. And so, you know, he's like Mick Jagger, and suddenly like Mick Jagger becomes, well, like a rock star. Well, how does he move? You know, and what is it about Mick Jagger? You know, what is it about these other, you know, musicians, these artists, you know, that's the form of expression to think about, not so much the scientist or the mad scientist, but the passionate artist. Mm-hmm. And then those ideas mix with the incredible genius Kate Hawley, who does these costumes, who also is bringing in all of her ideas of, like, you know, punk rock in London in the 60s and Jimi Hendrix and those bell bottoms and those hats, and that has a bit of a gothic romantic thing going for it. And then these little boots, and then suddenly I see these boots and I see this hat, but for me that looks more like Prince to me. And so then, you know, so then all these things are just conversations and pieces and things kind of being put together that create a character, you know. It is this amazing collaboration that happens, this collage that gives the impression of a character, and mm-hmm. that's really special.
You know, you're working opposite Jacob Elordi, and I think a lot of people come in with preconceived notions about maybe who he is as an actor on past work. He's such a revelation in this film in terms of the sort of work and prep that he did to get here. First, talk to me about seeing him as the creature for the first time, but also what he was like as a scene partner.
We only met briefly in Guillermo's office at one point, and seemed like a nice young fella, and he had his little, you know, 35mm camera. He was taking analog, a lot of analog pictures, which was cool. And the first scene we shot was the last scene of the movie, and that was the first time I saw him in the full getup. And so he walked in, and immediately I was really moved by how graceful he was. I remember him coming in like fingers first. You know, his hands were like animals, like sea anemones, you know, these just like incredible movements that were happening. And I found it, yeah, just really lonely and heartbreaking. I thought it was just an amazing coincidental, if you believe in those, opportunity that was the first scene that we were going to get to do together, the last scene, the time when these characters finally actually see each other for the first time. And he was amazing and so graceful and gentle and very emotionally available. Mm-hmm. And in between takes, I'd see this big lumbering monster taking photos with his little camera, which was incredible. What was incredible about that too is that he was loose. You know, he was loose, and he was just taking everything in. And that's a very hard thing to do in those high pressured situations. You know, people can kind of get like tunnel vision and narrow in and try just to do the thing that they want to do. But the fact that he was like open awareness, which was, it's like a place that we all hope to start from as artists.
Did you both have an idea of like, do we need to approach this a certain way to sort of be true to these characters and, you know, the friction or tension that they have? Or can we turn that off in between takes and have?
Yeah, no, there was none of that. There was no need to do any of that. That was just like, that would have been just extra, like, yeah, work, more like an ego idea.
Yeah.
It was very free on set, and that's Guillermo, you know, that comes from the top down. Mm-hmm. He's ebullient. He's joyous. He's loud. He's inclusive of everything. So there's no secrets. If he likes something, everybody knows it. If he doesn't like something, everybody knows it. Whatever he's working on, everybody knows it. And so it feels like a team. And so there wasn't really space for, you know, this kind of sheltering away or trying to manufacture some kind of dynamic.
Did your view or perspective on Victor shift over the course of making this film? Like, both as a son and as a father? Like, how did you sort of see him in the beginning, and how did it change by the end?
Yeah, as a father, I mean, it's funny because I have a lot of friends that have kids that have texted me saying like, wow, man, that made me feel really guilty watching Victor do that, because we can all think of those moments where we lose our patience and we yell, or we, you know, get angry at these very innocent beings that didn't ask to be here. And yet, you know, they're being forced to conform to these rules, right? And so, you know, and the idea that like what we think is right trumps everything, and that the that our children are just extensions of ourselves, accessories, things to be judged in relation to us, and as either prideful or shameful, and that horrible cycle that happens, and the thing that those patterns that we fall into. So that became more and more evident, especially as those scenes, you know, with Jacob as the creature, with the shaving and the washing and the being tired and all things that were additions from Guillermo that's not in the book. Because in the book, Victor just leaves right away. Mm-hmm. But it's like he's just, this is more of like a slow retreat from the responsibilities of bringing somebody into the world.
Well, I want to unpack that more, because it's been interesting to see the discourse online of people sort of very much relating to this element of Guillermo's take, which is, you know, the themes of generational pain and a father's desire for redemption. Obviously, Victor is physically and emotionally abused by his father, and we see how that sort of the cycle repeats itself with the creature. And, you know, this idea of breaking generational trauma, like you said, it's something that we try to be mindful of in how we work every day. And I know watching the film, there was some people where you could see like, oh, this is a therapy session kind of thing for me. For you, did you find yourself like unpacking some of those emotions in the process, or is it just something that you're sort of reflecting on now that it's over?
No, I mean, we spoke about those things at that first meeting, you know, so that was actually like the touchstone of the whole thing. That's what kept everything grounded. You know, it's a very heightened performance. It's not naturalistic. It's meant to be quite expressive. It also brings in, you know, modalities and forms of telenovelas and you know, Mexican melodrama. We watch those things very carefully to kind of bring some of those elements out in this kind of fever dream that is this film. But that was only, we were only able to do those kinds of things with knowing at the core it is about this generational trauma and this idea of what we inherit from our fathers, from our parents. And, you know, as much as we try to run away from them, we get blinded often by our own constructions of ourselves and our own egos and our own desires, and are blind to repeating these exact same things again. Mm-hmm. And especially, you know, as artists often, you know, these, we get, you know, I can definitely relate to the idea of like, well, if I can just figure out this one thing, this character, this piece, this, you know, if I can find the breakthrough, this honesty here, then everything will make sense. Everything will be worth it. All the limbs that I've, you know, cut off, all the villages I've burned, you know, all that the trail of dead I've left behind me will mean something if I can figure this thing out. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the other side of that, and it's just that's not the answer. And so we very much were conscious of that as we were making the movie.
Well, I guess because, you know, the interview I was referencing before, which I listened to a few years ago on a road trip, which was your interview with Terry Gross, which was around the time of Car Counter. I was so struck by you sort of talking about your upbringing in an evangelical household and this sort of knowing or feeling like doom was around the corner. Mm. And I was so struck by how you talked about that. And then there was the moment where you talked about, you know, your home in Florida sort of being demolished by the hurricane. And so in my rewatch of Frankenstein, you know, sort of focused on you and your character in particular, I was thinking about how much of that was playing in your head, especially like in the scene where the, you know, the place is burning down. Like, do you go directly to those kind of moments, or how was it playing in your head?
I don't necessarily try to summon that specific moment. I mean, I think part of the preparation is reading and feeling, you know, as I read through the script and as I think about it, where I connect with it emotionally. And sometimes if something feels far away, I do have to be like, okay, well, how do I bridge the gap to this thing? Like, well, how can I relate to it? Oh, well, I guess, yeah, I had to deal with, you know, this in my life, and how did I respond to it? Well, how would Victor respond to it? How would I respond to it if I had Victor's circumstances? That is, you know, that is some of the fun of meditating on the piece and thinking about what all the possibilities are. But with this, I didn't find myself like literally reaching to stories in my past. I just allowed that to be available.
Got it.
I did a bit with the last scene, you know, thinking about, well, when was the last time I was at a deathbed and with a loved one? Mm-hmm. And what was that like? And what do I remember physically of that? And, you know, what was the energy and what was the tone of that? And how is it appropriate with this? And how is it different? So I think it's, you know, you use whatever's available, and sometimes just the other person across from you is enough, and sometimes, you know, you need to kind of summon it from the ancestors or from wherever to you know, to get through that performance ritual.
When you're channeling those intense emotions, is it like hard to keep them under control sometimes for the good of the scene?
Yeah, well, actually that happened with this last scene. You know, I think, you know, I'd spent a day kind of getting into that mode and summoning, and we did the scene, and it was quite volatile sometimes. It was like a lot of emotions would come through, and Cameron would say like, okay, let's do another one, but maybe like tamp that down a little bit, you know? It's like, okay, let's try that again. And we did it a bunch of different ways. And funny enough, we ended up, even though it was a great day and everyone was happy, we ended up coming back and reshooting it again. And it was kind of done last minute. And so I didn't have time to do all of this preparation, and we just went. And that's actually what ended up being in the movie. Because I wasn't, you know, expending any energy trying to like reach for something. It just was more reactive, and it was a bit more sober, and it was less kind of an idea. Uh-huh. And so it's that balance sometimes between, you know, wanting to get to something, explore something, but also like letting it go and allowing something to emerge that is not willed.
I want to talk more about the collaboration with Guillermo. Like, what does that look like in practice? Like, what is a note from him like? And I think I saw another interview where you mostly spoke in Spanish with each other. So talk to me about like how that sort of allows you to sort of understand what he's after more easily.
Yeah, that first meeting, we only spoke in Spanish. And so it kind of set the tone. And you know, my Spanish is good, but it's like maybe like seventh grade, you know, vocabulary.
I feel a kinship.
You know, seventh, eighth grade, maybe like on a good day. And so I would speak in Spanish to my mom. You know, that was the person that I would only speak in Spanish to. And then when she passed 8 years ago,
I kind of lose that.
And I have my aunts and I talk to them, you know, but it kind of starts to go away, you know. And so to suddenly have Guillermo show up, and that was the way that we really first really like interfaced. And with him, even though he could hear me sometimes, you know, doing it in Spanglish or trying to get to it, he just was committed. It's like, we speak in Spanish. He didn't have to say it. It's just like, that's just what it is. And it just created this real, almost like subconscious intimacy, because it's the mother tongue. That is the first thing that I heard. That's what my mom would speak to me, only in Spanish. And, you know, and even though when I learned to speak, it was in the United States, it was both always at the same time. And then the English took over. But so it just hits something different, to have to communicate, to have to try to find a way to express myself in Spanish, Guillermo talking about really difficult things. But what would be great about it is that like it forced me to be simple and just like get to the fucking point, you know, and not like get all this intellectual stuff around and like all this, you know, all these like definitions and acting terms and all this. It's just like, what is it like here that you're trying to say? Mm. And that was a really special thing.
You know, we've talked a little bit about like working through, for lack of a better term, some daddy issues during the making of this. But, you know, I know that Hamlet is such a seminal text in both your personal life and in your career. And obviously this is a film that has themes. They share parallels there. And I know, you know, with the passing of your mom, working on this, especially with that last scene, like, how did you feel your mother while working on this project?
Wow, that's a very kind question. So much. I mean, she would have loved this movie. It's like exactly the last movie we saw, actually, was The Handmaiden, you know? Super erotic, too. I was like, Mom. We're like, sorry. But it's, yeah, close your eyes, Mom. But it was so beautiful and kind of dark and opulent. Like, she loved that stuff, you know? And so, she was always incredibly, incredibly present. You know, even the Elizabeth character, you know, my mom had red hair as well. And so, like, these elements is something that Guillermo and I talked a lot about. And just there's so much, and this is in Mary Shelley's text, about the feminine and the masculine and those warring kind of energies. And for Victor, ironically, like, really tapping into more of the feminine energy with him in some ways. You know, I mean, what he does is obviously, like, you know, like the penetrating nature, you know, like that is that kind of masculine thing. But at the same time, like, the kind of freedom and like the liquidity of that kind of femininity was very important too. I mean, that last scene, it was interesting. That first time we did the scene, there was a lot of my mom there. And then when I had to let it go and was there, you know, I had to just like respond, suddenly like dad showed up. You know, and that was really wild, you know, that it's like there's a bit of that warring energy with Victor all the time. And that was really surprising.
There was also the detail that people really picked up on, which was the drinking of the milk.
Mm-hmm.
What were those conversations like? The fact that we're getting details like that, and there is a lot of thought put into things like that. How did that sort of inform you as you played Victor?
Yeah. I mean, look, the thing is, he, once his mom dies, he gets stunted. Like, he never grows from that point on. His body grows, what he's doing, his intellect grows, but like, emotionally, like that, he stays that little boy that's been hit in the face by his dad, right? And rejected. And rejected by his mom because she died, you know? It's not rational, but that's what it is, you know? So he's orphaned. That's also why mom feels so present, right? He's just always looking for her. He's always looking for her everywhere. The milk is just like looking for her. It's just comfort. La lechita. You know, you'd always say, like, Guillermo, it's funny, you know, it's also very funny because it's like, it's so simple too, you know, but it's, it fills a few roles. It's that. It's also, you know, he likes playing with like the saint sinner thing, you know, this guy that paints himself as the victim. He's not a drug addict. He doesn't, the only thing he does is milk. It's like, milk's good for you, right? You know, he starts off as Jesus Christ and ends up as Charles Manson, you know, like that's this kind of idea. That's what that milk does.
Do you have a sense, especially with a little bit of hindsight now, though I know you're still in the whirlwind of it, but do you have a sense of, you know, what the character of Victor has done for you? Like,
you know, I think what was surprising is that he is a sadist, but in like the Marquis de Sade kind of way. I think it wasn't like something that I thought about, but as it progressed, you know, what was surprising to me was the pleasure that the character was giving me. For someone that is so dark and so has such capacity for cruelty, the fact that he just felt so good. It was so free and so energized and kind of joyful. And I asked Guillermo at one point, I was like, maybe something's wrong here, because like, shouldn't it be a little darker and heavier? And he's like, the movie tells you what it needs. He's like, you listen to the movie and this is somebody that doesn't have any doubts. And that feels pretty good to not have any doubts, you know, until he crashes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it all finally, he wakes up from this dream, this fever dream of no consequences. There's no consequences. Nothing matters. You know, it's the rule of nature is dominance and cruelty, and actually pain is the same as pleasure. And the more perfect the crime, which is against something that's virtuous and innocent, mm-hmm. the more perfect of an act that is, philosophically, nihilistically. So that is pure freedom. So pure freedom and pure pleasure is like, I mean, really, it's like, fuck it.
Right.
And so to play somebody like that, and to allow myself to be blind to the feeling of consequence and to just like shoot like a rocket, that was something that was incredibly freeing and pleasurable, as dark and as you know, then suddenly to stop back and look back and be like, oh, what an awful thing. What awful things he did. You know, he couldn't see what he was doing. But in the moment, yeah, that was unexpected.
Like, we talked about the intensity of filming that last scene. What was the scene where you just felt so free and happy or excited to, you know,
creating the creature?
Yeah.
Creating the creature was just like, you know, that's the rain coming down, the running up and down the stairs in the little high-heeled boots, the screaming at Christoph Waltz, you know, and him, his body flying down and me being like, fuck it, gotta throw him in the freezer, gotta keep this thing moving. You know, that energy, you know, climbing up the spear, the tower, putting the spear up there, and then Gita would be like, yeah, he's like a gothic hero, like gothic superhero, you know, that kind of mutability within the character. It's kind of like what I was saying about the artist. It's like, this I know how to do this, and if I can do this, everything will make sense. Mm-hmm. So that moment of like just purely going for that thing, that was a really exciting moment. And also in that set, in Tamara's incredible set with Dan's lighting and Guillermo sitting there in the corner like this little crazy Mexican Buddha, you know, just like wanting more, more, more. That was electrifying, pardon the pun.
No, I've wondered what it's like walking into one of, you know, his creations, those sets. I can't imagine.
Yeah.
It feels like you're in a dream.
You do. And what's the most incredible thing is that he's surrounded himself with people for the last 30 years that are like extensions of himself, right? It's through a process of elimination, he's gotten these people that are just as passionate, just as detailed, and have ownership of the movie. So the set decorator, the painter, the person that's just the greens person that puts the moss in is like, do you see where I put the moss right there? You see the moss right there? You know, it's like that kind of artisanal passion over it. So you walk in, sure, it's inspiring for the imagination, but it's also inspiring as a craftsperson to be like, okay, how do I bring the same amount of detail and passion and love for it?
I'm asking this teasingly, but what's the worst thing about Guillermo as a director? Is it that, like, he wants so many takes, or is it that, like, he just thinks you can do anything? Like, what is his you know, his drawback?
His drawback. It's even that's not a drawback. So I was going to say what was challenging was to have somebody quilting the movie as we were shooting it so that, you know, you would do a take, and sometimes it would go straight into the edit and he could show you it in the movie itself. Wow. And as an actor, that could be tough because you're like, oh, I'm not ready to see that yet. You know? But he was making it as it goes because the camera was always moving. So he kind of needed to see that it was always connecting to the next thing. So I had never experienced that before where, you know, for instance, that last scene, we did it the next day he came in and it was all edited with some temp score on it, you know, and I saw it. I was like, oh no, I don't think that's, oh no, you know, but in that case, it was good that I saw it and had that reaction because we got to have another go at it. But it is like, you know, dealing with like, how much do I want to see? How self-conscious am I? But it's again, it's like his openness, you know, he's not afraid.
Was he open with Jacob having his dog Layla on set?
Yeah, that's the thing. He was just free. He was really free. Like, he's like, whatever you need, man, whatever anybody needs, that's it. He would embrace everything, every mistake he'd embrace.
Before we wrap things up, I mean, I know we've talked about, you know, you're sort of swirling in this space of loss and renewal. And I know in addition, you know, to tapping into that with Frankenstein, your wife, who's a filmmaker, Elvira Lind, has this documentary, King Hamlet, where, you know, she documented a very transformative period in your life as you dealt with the loss of your mother, but also the birth of your child. How has it been to sort of live in this space and to sort of, you know, have these parallel kind of moments between these two projects?
Yeah, what a beautiful question. Yeah, in a way, it's like the father and the mother of these projects here. Yeah, and the strange, you know, synchronicity of when they're coming out at the same time. It's kind of a beautiful thing because Frankenstein is massive. You know, it's this massive thing. It's very expressive. It's, you know, it has a lot of so many people, so much energy behind it, and then you know having to do that, and then flying to New York and showing a small group of people this tiny little movie, you know, made by just a handful of people, mostly my wife, this incredible documentary filmmaker, but made by her again by hand, about this really small, quiet time of a play that we did that, you know, maybe a few thousand people saw, you know, there is something that, I think that, it's kind of quite grounding about that, you know, and also feels generous because it's about something that she's made. But also it's about showing, you know, a little peek for anybody, but also for artists as well. And, like what it costs sometimes and what it takes and how this particular family dealt with all this happening and the desire and the need to process it and create something out of it.
Well, thank you so much for taking your time with me today. Thanks for Frankenstein.
Thank you. Thank you. Beautiful questions. Thank you.
After the break, Mark's conversation with Wumi Masaku.
For the Los Angeles Times and The Envelope, I'm Mark Olson, and we're here today with Wumi Masaku, one of the stars of the film Sinners. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The movie obviously opened earlier in the year, but it's really just sort of hung in there. It's a movie people are still talking about. What does it mean to you that the movie already has had such an enduring life?
Oh, it means so much to me. I feel like, you know, you take a job because you believe in it and you trust the filmmakers and you're excited. And then you get on set and you do your best. And then all of a sudden you like remember that it's going to be out there and people are going to judge it and they might not like it and they may not like you and they might not respond to it. And, you know, we would turn to each other sometimes and be like, do you think they're going to feel how we feel about this? Just like, I hope so. I really hope so, because we really felt like it was so special. And so having the reaction, like seeing the reaction, has been so affirming and pretty magical, because it's not always the case that it translates the same as how it feels for you. The audience feel that too.
And what do you think it is that audiences are responding to?
I think Ryan Coogler, his way of creating art is always based in truth and connection and honoring like the people on the screen and the people that they represent in and around his life. And so I feel like people are responding to the fact that it feels truthful, even though it's like got horror aspects and a musical aspect, and it really just has heart and depth. And it's about community, it's about freedom, it's about the price of freedom, it's about so many things that affect people every day. Capitalism, selling out, like cultural appropriation, it's about so many things. It's deep and it's layered, and it's all rooted in truth.
And now, when you say that as you were shooting the movie it felt special to all of you, can you describe that for me? Like, what do you think you were feeling as you were shooting the movie?
I felt a deep connection to my ancestry, to my purpose, to how what I do today will reverberate in the future, my lineage, my child's future. I mean, I just felt the film links the past to the present. It links African, like West African traditional spirituality, and it connects it to like hip hop and blues and all these different types of dance and culture like that. That's of the diaspora. It feels kind of sprawling and encompassing of the Black diaspora experience. And it makes you feel connected to everyone, in the diaspora. So that's how I felt. Like, I felt really like awakened to my position in that web of creativity and like artists like Ryan, who have this visionary, like revolutionary way of creating. They just kind of feel like guiding lights, diamonds, like in this web of us. It feels like, oh wow, he really is like this jewel to be cherished, and I'm connected to that now. So it was very multi-layered, the connection I felt.
That does sound like more than just like sort of a typical day at work.
Definitely. there was nothing typical about it. It felt like vibrationally it changed all of us.
And now, as I understand it, when you auditioned for the film, you were given this sort of 7-page scene that introduces your character of Annie. It's you and the Michael B. Jordan's character of Smoke. And from that scene, you thought the film was a romantic drama.
Mm-hmm.
What did you make of it when you found out what the movie was really about?
And Ryan explained the movie to me in and around the scene. And my mind was blown because it made complete sense, but it came completely out of left field for me. I had like the themes that we see in the movie of like the evolution of blues to modern day music and ancestors and future ancestors, they weren't quite there when he was explaining it to me, but it was there in the spirit of what he was explaining to me. So I knew it was epic, and that was there was depth, but then there was also vampires. And I don't know how he, I can't explain how he explained it, but I felt the weight of all of the themes and messages, and it seemed to work with the idea of vampires coming in and taking bloodsuckers, you know? It was a surprise, but it made sense. I was completely hooked and in from the first scene, mm-hmm. but his description, I was like, this is genius.
But then I like the idea that you were still able to sort of like process your story in the movie, Annie's story, as that of a romance, that with everything else that's happening in the film, there still is that story at the core of it.
Because he only works with truth, even in a fantastical world of vampires and spirits. He still works within the truth of relationships and character dynamic. And so their love is the community, the love and the bond between all of the characters, that is the heart of the movie. You know, Sammy's desire to like leave the plantation and see the world, like that's the heart of the movie. These two people who love each other dearly and are insatiable for each other, but can't be together because of racism and the color of their skin. Like that heartbreak is the heart of the movie. A woman who just wants to sing and is young and is married to this old church type. That line I think is cut from the movie, but she said, Jamie's character says he's old, church type, and she just wants to be like, she's completely free on the stage, that, and she gets to like explore and have this thrilling night in the community in the juke joint. I mean, that's the heart of the movie, like that's the beating heart. These relationship to the beating heart.
But there's something I've heard you talk about that I want to hear you maybe talk about a little more, which is simply that Annie relates to the character that most of us know as Smoke, as both Smoke and Elijah, his given name. Can you sort of untangle that for me a little bit? It's something that, like, I find really compelling to think that she, like, is relating to kind of both sides of his personality.
Well, everybody has a representative, right? Like, this is my representative. And then there's Wumi at home without the glam, without that, the truth. So yes, she met Smoke. She fell in love with Smoke, but she knew Elijah. And, you know, in Yoruba, we have your given name, and then you get given an Oriki name. And the Oriki name is the name that, like, it's like a pet name that your grandmother or your mom would call you. And when they call you by that name, really what they're saying to you is, when you hear someone speak your Oriki name, you can't say no.
Mm.
You can't say no. It's like, that person knows me like no one else. And they've used this name for a purpose. So, like, almost Elijah is his Oriki name because everyone knows him as Spoke. He has his defenses up. He has his heart guarded. You know, Smoke's been through war. Smoke's been through the gangster stuff in Chicago. But Elijah lost his daughter.
Mm.
So when she calls him by his name, it's like calling his Oriki.
Mm. Because you've spoken as well about how much you feel you've learned about yourself in playing this role, that it changed you. How so?
I mean, even the fact that I can talk about Oriki names. I have an Oriki name. I didn't understand the meaning of the Oriki name until I just kind of immersed myself more in my culture that I feel like I had no choice in not being a part of. I came to England when I was 1 and a half, and you know, you try and assimilate, you try and fit in, and that is at the expense and cost and the tax of your birth culture. And that's something that people don't really pay attention to, what's lost in order to feel safe in another culture. Researching Annie, I had to look back at where I'm from, because she's a hoodoo priestess, and hoodoo is a derivative of Ifa, and Ifa is the traditional Yoruba religion. That is where my people come from. That is part of my survival. That's why I'm here. Their knowledge, their belief systems, that is why I'm here. And so having to research that just opened up a whole treasure trove of truth for me, and inquiry and self-reflection and self-love and admiration of all the people that came before, the difficult decisions my parents made, 2 movers, and then the difficult decisions I've had to make in navigating being an immigrant in another country.
Mm-hmm. And what has it meant to you to sort of, like, connect with that part of yourself?
I'm unable to put it into words. It's changed me profoundly. It's changed my relationship to the world, my culture, my home. I feel inspired in so many different ways to reconnect, feel connected. I've been doing Yoruba lessons for 5 years, and only in the last year has it really stuck.
Mm.
Like, now I can, and I think the sticking is because of the exploration, the real exploration, not just an intellectual trying to learn a language. It's unlocked something emotionally in me. The language is sticking.
Sinners is rooted so specifically in the world of the Jim Crow South here in America. Was that still something that you could relate to? I mean, were there aspects of the story that still felt familiar to you?
yeah, I can relate to being Black in America. I can relate to being Black in a different culture. But there's a lot of research that has to be done. For me, like, you know, a lot of people in the cast were pulling upon the people that they knew and their history and their ancestry, whether it was, you know, Ryan and his uncle James, who inspired the movie. You know, Miss Ruth said my dress, the velvet dress, was inspired by a picture of her grandma in a velvet dress on the stairs with her grandfather. They have different things they can pull on that are really from the time and the people. I do research in a different way because I don't have that same history to pull from, but I have an admiration and a love and of the African American culture. My daughter's African American. So I feel like I have a respect and a duty to do my research, not just for my character work, but for my family. So yeah, it's different, but I can relate to aspects, but I can't relate to, I mean, I don't have that shared cellular memory, you know, that the rest of the cast do.
So what did you draw on for research?
I spoke to hoodoo priestesses and that was really my main research was kind of the faith, because that is who she is. That's her foundation. And that's her power. So that was my main research. Obviously, researching the era, you know, Prohibition, Jim Crow South, the, you know, Great Migration, the beginnings of. So I think for me, it's about respect and honoring as truthfully as I can if someone has trusted me with this role. And also, I've said no to roles that I don't think should be played by Black Brits or Nigerians. I have said no to roles that I think should be specifically for African Americans. There's something about Annie that feels really close to me and really important to me. And I think she's like a bridge. And I do think of myself sometimes in that way of like kind of in the middle of, you know, I'm someone who was born in Nigeria but was never raised there. Someone who has lived in a, you know, raised on a land that has never felt like my own. And then someone who's come here and has, not inherited, but I have a daughter with this inherited history. And so I have a responsibility for her to understand all three aspects of, and then I'm sure there are more aspects of her history that I am yet to figure out what they are, that it's my responsibility to understand that and guide her with it.
And then when you're shooting these kind of stories or dealing with these really sort of heavy topics, do you have anything that you like to do sort of at the end of the day to pull yourself out of it?
I talk to my husband and I spend time with my daughter. I talk to my family. I go home.
And I don't think I'm spoiling anything, but I want to be sure to ask you about sort of your last moments in Sinners. It's deeply moving. You sort of reappear in the film as a vision to Smoke. You're nursing your infant daughter. Can you talk to me about that moment in the film and what it means to you?
It's purity. He drops his representative. He drops Smoke. He has to drop Smoke in order to join us. Mm. The initial cost of like this never-ending life as a vampire, this initial cost, like it sounds like there's a glamour to it. There's a capitalism to it. There is this like they, you know, Smoke, Stack and Mary are still young and beautiful and But there is such a great cost. They never get to see the sun. They never get to hold their loved ones again. And actually, they're not truly free. Whereas Smoke and Annie have chosen true freedom that fully incorporates everything that they love, truly. It's not money. It's not eternal life. It's not eternal darkness. No sun. Like, this is... They are basking in the sun with their ancestors, and that's just it's purity, it's love, it's freedom.
I have to ask you about the scene in the movie. It's a musical number where sort of the past and the future sort of collapse in on themselves. What did that read like in the script, and what was it like to be on set that day?
It read very much like it felt when you watched it. It was, I had read a version without the future and past ancestors, like where it was just about the two brothers and their women and reconnecting, and it was beautiful. It was so beautiful. I loved it. And then before the read through, we got given another draft, and it had the ancestors and the roof going on fire, and it was like, I threw the script down and I ran into my living room. I was like, to my husband, I was like, oh my god, it's amazing, it's amazing. I mean, I think this is the most amazing thing I've ever read. I think it's the most amazing thing that's ever gonna happen on screen. I hope. That's how it felt. And in the on the day filming it, it very much felt, it was magical. Sammy and Delta Slim have this scene where Delta talks to him about his gift and his and where it comes from. It comes from the homeland. It comes from your ancestors. It comes from home, Africa. And it's such a powerful gift, and to really guard it with all he has. Then Miles, who plays Sammy, is talking to the older guy, Papa Toto, who plays his past ancestor, who has the little guitar behind the I don't know what it's called, like the original guitar, and he's behind him in the scene, and then I kind of wander over to them, and Papa Toto basically does the exact same speech, never having read the script, to Miles about his gift and where it comes from and like how we should cherish it and keep it protected. That's what they're both talking about, protecting their gifts, this boy's gift. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is like magical. This is magical. This is, he doesn't even know that this is the scene in the script. Yeah, it was a really special day.
I'm going to ask this as politely as I can, but I found Sinners to be a much bawdier movie than I expected it to be. It's a much more sensual and kind of sexy movie than I expected when I went to see it. And I'm curious how you found those scenes in the script, and in particular what it was like for you, your scene with Michael.
It explores so many different like emotions and feelings. It feels palpable. It feels tangible. It feels like it's pulsing. It also feels kind of inevitable. So, you know, if true, again, it just felt true. And it wasn't difficult if everyone, because we create such a safe space for everyone. And it, you know, there's no nudity in it. And it just feels really sensual and safe.
And what was it like shooting scenes with Michael where he's playing both Stack and Smoke? I would imagine, just in the him having to switch out for the scenes, and I know he had this kind of unusual camera harness he would wear sometimes. Like, how did that impact the sort of the rhythm and the momentum of for the rest of you?
It was pretty easy for us, honestly. We didn't have to do anything. Michael had a stand-in, Percy Bell, and they both would learn both twins' lines, and then Michael would shoot a Stack, and Percy would do Smoke, and we would lock this, we would rehearse that, and then shoot it, find the one we liked and lock it. So if this is Percy and this is Stack, what they would do is he would go get changed, be Smoke, and we would kind of mime the scene. It was really harder for Mike because I don't know how he did it. We would kind of mime the scene. They would play the scene back, so he was responding to us in the real time of this of the scene that they had chosen. It was no, like, you know, that was it. That was the only scene that we were going with. And then he would, like, trace Percy's steps and physique, so he to make sure he wouldn't step on Stack or whatever. So it was very easy for us. Like, we just had to play the scene. And it was, I honestly don't know how Mike did it. I have no idea how he did it.
And then what has the response to the movie been like for you just professionally? Like, do you find you've gotten some offers? Are you finding yourself in rooms that maybe you wouldn't be have been in before?
Everyone has been so complimentary and lovely about the movie. You know, I think work has come from it. And, you know, this, you know, like, I was in a room at the Governor's Awards with, like, Tom Cruise and Debbie Allen and Felicia Rashad. I was like, well, this is new. You know, we were at the L. We got awarded, me, Jamie, and Haley got awarded one of the Ellen Women Hollywood Awards yesterday, mm-hmm. which was, again, really surreal. Like, oh, hey, Jennifer Aniston. Hey, Rose Byrne. Hey, everyone. Hi, we're in this room with you. Cool. So yeah, it's a lot of really lovely things have come of it. Yeah, very grateful.
And what does it mean to you that it's for this movie in particular?
This is the movie that just keeps on giving. I loved it from the first time I read those 7 pages, and I have grown as a person, as an actor, as a mom, as a wife, and now I'm experiencing this, which is really lovely, really nice.
And now you also have an upcoming role in The Social Reckoning, Aaron Sorkin's sequel to The Social Network. Is there anything you can tell us about your role in the movie?
I have no idea what I'm allowed to say about it. Like, I've not been prepped on press for that yet, so I'm sorry.
Have you shot your part?
I've shot a lot. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I know that that's a movie that people are very excited about, and certainly excited to see you in it as well. Wumi Masaku, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And make sure you join us next episode. That'll be January 8th, where we'll have a chance to talk to Joel Edgerton of Train Dreams. You don't want to miss it.